and I'll record this too. I've got my little recorder here. I've been asked to record the teachings that I do tonight, but I want to put this on pause when we discuss things, because if you say personal things, I don't want it to be distributed. But what I have to say about this stuff, there's some folks in the church that want to hear what I have to say about it, but are not here. So that's why I remind me if I don't push that little button. Try to keep the private things private. Yeah. So I thought we.
I just have one question. What personal things would you say about
premillennialism? I don't know. I don't know.
Covering all your bases.
I want to cover all my bases. Oh,
Did you just push the red button?
I didn't push it yet. We're talking. So anyway. Things can get kind of personal when you're talking about the rapture and stuff, I guess. First thing I wanted to just sort of tell a little story about and a little teaching about the idea of pigeonholing. And I'm reluctant to do a lot of representation about what other people believe, because first of all, I haven't spent all my life looking at what other people believe. I spent most of my life trying to figure out what God believes. And I think that's the right thrust. And there's always a good chance you misrepresent what other people think if you start saying, well, you know, this group believes this and that group believes that. And so I'm going to speak in generalities about some of these things, and some stuff I do not know, and I don't pretend to be an expert on premillennialism or postmillennialism or some of these other words. And I'm not even going to get into dispensational stuff. I'm just going to give a broad map of some of the different places people are coming from as far as Revelation goes, and that's my idea tonight. And why I believe that the fourth one on this chart here is probably the right one. And I've given you a number of reasons for that over the course of our classes on Revelation. I was a Christian not for too long, maybe a year or two, when I discovered there were some groups that were calling me and our brethren Campbellites. And it just mystified me, you know. Well, what do you mean Campbellite? You know, I like their soup. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know about Alexander and Thomas Campbell. For me, I'm a Bibleite. I try to follow the Bible, and there is no, you know, what pigeonhole are you trying to put me in? I don't know what that was all about, you know. And come to find out, you know, that people call, sometimes they'll call us Campbellites because Thomas and Alexander Campbell were involved in the Reformation movement and started to publicize the idea of baptism for the forgiveness of sins and that kind of thing. And then people who believe that way, Campbellites. Well, yeah, okay. If they want to agree with what I believe about the Bible, if we both agree with the Bible, that's great. But there are a whole bunch of other things, you know, to believe in. And you don't always fit in one pigeonhole. Anybody remember the name of Alexander Campbell's newsletter? The Millennial Harbinger.
Millennium Falcon.
Yeah. Well, what it tells me, and what his main thrust in his newsletter was, the coming of the Lord's Church was going to usher in the 1,000-year reign, which was completely different from what I've been teaching over the past 20 some odd weeks. Am I a Campbellite? No, I mean, I'm a Jackite or whatever. I'm a Bibleite, you know. We just try to do our best to find out what the Bible has to say, and not everybody fits into exactly the same pigeonhole, and not even the same person is going to fit into the same pigeonhole next week or next year or 5 years from now. You may learn more about the Bible and change your mind about something, and I'd be surprised if you didn't. And in a way, I'd be sort of disappointed, because it's a sign of growth if you understand things more deeply and you get to be a little closer to Jesus over a period of time. So with that in mind, I don't want to use these as labels for groups or anything like that, but these are sort of ideas that you'll stumble across as you talk to people. And the main ideas from this chart I'd like to look at are the idea of the millennium, first of all. And that's one of the big issues about this. On our chart, you've got three timelines. Everybody's agreed at the end of the timeline is the last judgment. Okay, that's it. Okay, there's coming a time when everybody who ever lived is going to be sorted out, and God's calling everything, wrapping up everything, and the good and evil, and the forgiven and the unforgiven, and there's all of eternity after that. And all of these diagrams agree with that. There's always that last judgment. The top three have this chunk that's called the millennium. And that comes from Revelation chapter 20, where Satan was bound. The dragon was bound with a chain and thrown into the pit for 1,000 years. And so verses 2 and 3. And he laid hold of the dragon. This is an angel. Laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who was the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Then I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark on their forehead and on their hand. And they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. There you go. We've got 1,000-year reign. Now, the idea, the millennial views, the premillennial and postmillennial views, have the idea that this is a literal on the earth 1,000-year reign where Jesus is coming to be king on David's throne in Jerusalem, and he's going to reign for 1,000 years. And those who belong to God, those who belong to Christ, those who have gone through the persecution, they're going to reign with him on the earth. And they're also indicating that a lot of the Old Testament passages point to that, because a lot of Old Testament passages talk about the Messiah restoring the glory of Israel. And so what is done with that millennium in this passage has to do with the idea of premillennial, postmillennial, or amillennial. Whether a person is a millennialist or an amillennialist. Now, if you're a millennialist in general, whether you're postmillennialist or a premillennialist, is the idea is there's literally 1,000-year reign coming. It hasn't happened yet. And in the meantime, God's got his church, but the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophets and the fulfillment of Revelation is yet to come, and it's going to happen in that 1,000-year reign. So, you know, the Son of David is going to reign on David's throne in Jerusalem, and that hasn't happened literally. The Jews were sort of expecting that, and they didn't expect it. There's going to be this. And what amillennialists believe is that the 1,000 years is a figure. It's a symbol. It's used of the complete victory that God would have, that Jesus would have over the Romans, who are going to be persecuting the church very quickly, and that Jesus was always reigning from the time of the resurrection until the last day. He is reigning. He is king, and his kingdom has already been set up. And it was never meant to be a physical, come back down to Jerusalem, reign on the earth kind of a kingdom, but Jesus' kingdom is not of this realm. He told that to Pilate. He told that to the people he taught down on earth. That his kingdom is the kingdom of heaven. And He's seated on his throne right now, and he's still seated on his throne. And when we're talking about this in Revelation 20, we're talking about we got through the persecutions, we overcame, and we're on top with Jesus. It doesn't say Jesus started to reign at this point. Notice it said that the saints reigned with Christ. And it doesn't even say where those thrones were set up. Really. I mean, even if you're going to take it literally, it doesn't specifically say the thrones were in Jerusalem. He just said they were set up. And so amillennialists believe that the millennium doesn't really have anything to do with the last day. It doesn't have anything to do with the final judgment or anything like that. We believe that the church is God's kingdom. Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies about a restored Israel are fulfilled in the church. God made us to be a kingdom, priests, a royal priesthood. The beginning of Revelation talks about how we are the kingdom. Other parts in the Bible and the New Testament talk about how the church is God's kingdom, how we are stones in God's temple. The temple, the kingdom are all fulfilled in the church, and that goes on. And that's why in the diagram here you have this big long swath here. That's God's kingdom. You know, it's right after the resurrection and going on until the end. Jesus is king. We are part of his kingdom. It's an eternal kingdom, and it's a kingdom that that we belong to. We're sojourners on this earth, but we belong to his kingdom. And when we have victory over Satan, we're reigning with him. It's a triumph with him. And so that's the distinction between amillennial and the top three here. There are a number of other reasons why I believe the amillennialists are true, and we talked about that this morning in sermon, and also in along the way. There's that sense of urgency in the book of Revelation. The very beginning of the book and the very end of the book is say, hey, what we're writing about is going to happen real soon. Listen up. I'm coming quickly. It's about to take place. It will shortly take place. Those phrases are used several times in the beginning and end of the book. And it really doesn't make quite so much sense to be saying all of that and expecting or looking at a 2,000-year gap between the cross and the present, and the millennium still hasn't happened yet. I mean, if it's going to happen soon, 2,000 years doesn't sound like too much of a soon. To me, it would make more sense that he was talking about, you know, the onslaught of that really severe persecution that the Romans were going to implement, starting with Domitian and continuing on after that for a while, and then our ultimate triumph. It makes more sense. But what happens is we're saying the introduction to Revelation and the end of Revelation are the literal parts, are the parts that are to be taken most literally. In other words, he was really serious when it says it's going to happen soon because it happened in their lifetime. And then when he talks about dragons and beasts and harlots and locusts that have tails like scorpions and horses that have tails like snakes, that it's figurative. And that's, you know, pretty much why I chose this particular view, because it makes more sense that the imagery in the center of the book would be more figurative and the more plain statements toward the beginning and end appear to be much more direct and logical. So that's the other argument that would go along with this. And then there's one other argument too, and I thought it was rather interesting. I didn't get to share it with anybody yet. Well, Jim McGuigan came up with it in his commentary, but it's a good one. In verse 18 of chapter 22, I testify to anyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book, if anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues which are written in this book. Okay, let's stop here for a minute. Now, if the plagues are literal, and the plagues were something that were supposed to happen just before the millennium starts, what about the guy who added to the book back in, 960 A.D.? I mean, somebody who's, you add to the book, you disregard God's word, you mess it up really bad, and you're going to be punished for it. But if you're going to be punished, are you going to be punished with literally those plagues? Well, he'd sort of have to be bopping around still waiting for those plagues to happen for him to be involved in it. Right? I mean, he says the plagues that are in the book, and the plagues that are in the book, if they're literal, they haven't happened yet. If the plagues in the book are figurative, and they are a picture of God's divine wrath in general, well, it makes sense. In other words, if we take away from the book now, we face God's wrath, the same kind of stuff. Yeah, and that's the idea. Mm-hmm. Right, the plagues, the things that happen in the middle of the book, the locusts and the water turning to blood and the whole business. Well, he isn't literally talking about facing those specific plagues. He's saying, hey, you're going to face God's wrath. And what that amillennial position takes is these are figures picturing God's wrath on the people that have been persecuting him. It's not meant to be, well, the waters really are going to turn into blood and the streams are really going to turn into wormwood and everybody's going to get boils. He uses the same images from what happened in Pharaoh's time to let people know that, hey, this is the same God who has the same power and has the same will to rescue his people. But it wasn't meant to be a word for word going to happen exactly like it happened in the vision kind of a thing. Now, the millennial folks see it in a much more literal fashion. And since we haven't seen these plagues, it hasn't happened yet. It's going to happen. And that's one of the big differences between the two.
They're still waiting mm-hmm. for all this to happen.
Yes. Yes. Okay. And you'll see, like in the Left Behind series of books. I mean, it's really neat. It reads sort of like a science fiction. And it's kind of, maybe adds a little romance to it and all this other kind of stuff. It is intended to be a fiction, a Bible-based fiction. He personalizes it. And it's a nice read. But it gives you sort of a general idea of what they think is going to take place. And it's a future thing because we haven't seen it literally take place. And that's the big difference between the top three views and the bottom view here, the amillennial view. In other words, we're saying, yes, there is a second coming, there is a final judgment, and that's going to all happen in the end. And in between the cross and the end, Jesus is reigning and his church is his kingdom. And that the book of Revelation is meant to get the early church through this really bad persecution and prepare the church for possible future persecutions. Because after all of this business, what happens? Gog and Magog come out. And guess what happens to Gog and Magog? Blam, God smites them. He sends the fire down from heaven and takes care of them too. So the picture, the amillennial view is the stuff in the center of the book is figurative. It's meant to remind God's people that, yeah, God's still in control and these people will be judged and condemned and we are going to win. We are the winners. And not only then, but in the future, whenever it happens, whenever any other kind of persecution comes, he still is going to be with us all the way to the end. And then a picture of our eternal hope and what the riches that we have laid up for us in heaven. And that's the picture that that I get from Revelation. And that's why I believe the amillennial view. Now, I didn't explain the top three views here. I say the top three, the first three on the chart. I'd like to introduce another idea here, and that's from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We looked at this a couple of weeks ago when I said, yes, there really is a resurrection. And we looked at this passage and we looked at 1 Corinthians 15. There is a bodily resurrection that's going to happen at the last day. And everybody pretty much agrees on that part. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Paul is dealing with people who are worried about, you know, if Jesus comes after some of their friends have died in Christ, what's going to happen to them? Did they miss out? And Paul's answer was, no, they're not going to miss out. In verse 13, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13, but we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve as the rest who have no hope. For we believe, if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep. Okay, so his answer was, look, our brothers and sisters who died in the Lord before Jesus came, they're not going to lose out. And this is the point. They're not, you know, we're not going to be get there ahead of anybody else who's died before us. And then he goes on and explains, for the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, this is verse 16, with the voice of the archangel and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we shall always be with the Lord. Okay. So this is a picture. We're here. Jesus comes. The people who died in the Lord are risen from the grave. And they go up to be with the Lord. And we're risen. And we go up to be with the Lord. That's the picture that's here. Now, I place this, and I think rightly so, at the very end. This is a last day picture. There is a phrase here. Let's see. I think it's in, okay, verse 17. This phrase, mine says, will be caught up. What does the others, you have other translations that say something else besides caught up?
Mine says caught up.
Anybody says snatched up? The original has the idea of snatched up, and it's a picture of like a hawk or an eagle swooping down, grabbing its victim, and then flying off with it. You ever hear the word raptor?
Yes.
Rapture.
And that's where they get the idea of the rapture. This is the rapture, you see. Those who belong to Christ will be snatched up, and it's like, whoa, what happened? And so if this car doesn't have a driver, you know the rapture came because I've been snatched up. And so this is identified with what's known as the rapture. And then there's a whole disagreement among people who are millennialists about when that happens. The post-millennialists believes that the rapture happens at the last judgment, just like we do. That this is talking about the last day. In other words, the rapture happens after the millennium, so they're post-millennial. After the millennium. That's what it means. So when does the rapture happen? Well, it happens either before or after the millennium. It happens after the millennium. We think it doesn't have anything to do with the millennium, and the millennium was figurative. But if you believe in the millennium, you're post-millennial if the rapture happens at the last day. It happens after the millennium's over. It's not a very prevalent belief, but it's out there, and that's one of the ideas. The other two believe that the rapture happens before the millennium. And so they're called pre-millennial. And that's where the name pre-millennial comes from. And so their idea is Jesus comes, he raptures his people, and after that there's the 1,000-year reign, And then after that, there's the judgment. So essentially, there's two comings, in a sense. And so the premillennials, you know, see this is happening before the millennium. And so the rapture comes before the millennium. And even here, there's a distinction. They have a post-tribulational and pre-tribulational millennialism. Don't ask me about the dispensational part. I'm not going to open that particular can right now. I'd like to learn too, but I don't know how much time I have to figure it all out. But the idea is, you know, when does this rapture happen? If you're a premillennialist, it happened before the millennium. Some believe it happens after the tribulation, but before the millennium. In other words, you know, after the trumpets and after the bowls are poured out and all of the garbage that goes on, then the saints rise and there's the rapture. And it kind of makes sense because it talks about those who've been beheaded come back to life and stuff. And I can see where they're thinking along those lines. So just before the 1,000-year reign, then there's a rapture of those who are in Christ. And then there's a second resurrection at the end of the thing, at the end of everything. And so that's the first one. And then the pre-tribulation premillennialism had the idea of people are raptured before all of the horrible stuff starts happening. And I guess they get the idea. And now here I'm a little bit on thin ice, but I imagine there's differences there as far as when it's going to happen. But it's sort of the idea of God marking his people and protecting them for when the judgment's coming is sort of the idea, whether it comes before the bowls are poured out or whether it comes during the time of the trumpets. But there's a rapture that comes before the great tribulation, before the struggle between the beasts and that kind of thing. And that's pretty much how it breaks down.
All these different groups don't realize that all they're doing is adding more confusion to the simplicity, really.
It does. It does. There is a lot of confusion about all of this. The basic idea of the premillennialism is that the rapture is going to happen before the tough stuff. The tribulation is going to happen before the 1,000-year reign. You know, the persecution and the Antichrist and the beasts and all of that. All of that's going to happen for a short time before the 1,000-year reign, and the rapture happens before that. That's premillennial. Premillennial, pre-tribulation, premillennial. And
oh my goodness.
To me, it makes a little more sense that that if there was a rapture before the millennium, it should be after the tribulation. That would make a little bit more sense. But I think what makes the most sense is that the millennium really is a figure, and that the rapture happens at the last day. And I think that's probably the most straightforward explanation of the whole business. Another piece of the puzzle, piece of the confusion in a way, comes from Matthew chapter 24 and the other passages where Jesus is, in context, Jesus is answering his apostles. Jesus had visited the temple for one of the last times before he was arrested and crucified. And the disciples had been looking around at the temple that Herod the Great had put together, and the oohing and aahing, and it was all filigreed with gold, and it had it was like one of the wonders of the world kind of thing. And Jesus said, you know, you see all this stuff? That's a pile of rubble. A day is coming really soon where one rock isn't going to be standing on another of all the stuff you're looking at. And then when they got back to where they were staying, they asked him, hey, when is this going to happen? And then Jesus goes into this long discourse about how different things are going to happen and that kind of thing. And in the midst of it, he talks about they're going to see the Son of Man coming in the clouds, in verse 30. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And they will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Oh, that sounds like the last day, doesn't it? It does. It sounds a lot like the last day. And then further down, he said, it's going to be like the time of Noah, when they were just living their lives normally, and then all of a sudden the flood came on. And then in verse 40, he says, then there will be two men in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two will be grinding at the mill, and one will be taken and one will be left. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. Okay, so here it sounds like, boy, this sounds like the end of the world. But it sounds like the rapture, because some folks are going to be snatched away and some people aren't. And so they identify this passage with 1 Thessalonians 4 and say, this is the rapture. Now, how does it fit in with Revelation? Okay, this is where it's all coming from, as far as I can tell. And so this passage, they believe, is the rapture. And of course, there's a disagreement about when it comes among the millennialists. And we talked a little bit about this before, or maybe some other time we can look at it in more detail if we want to. But I believe that what Jesus is talking about is Jesus coming in judgment against Jerusalem to put an end to the Jewish persecution and to avenge the Jewish persecution of the Christians. That he was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in the context. And if you go a little bit further down, let's see. Okay, in verse 34, truly, truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. In the parallel passages, it says, when you see these things, flee to the hills. The parallel passages even give a better picture of what's going on here, but Jesus is not necessarily talking about a universal judgment and resurrection, but as much as I'm coming and I'm punishing Jerusalem. And the reason I believe this is because in other passages in the Old Testament, God used that same kind of language talking about the punishment of Jerusalem back in the Old Testament days, the punishment of Edom, the punishment of Egypt, and other places. God came on a swift cloud to bring an end to, or to bring punishment on Egypt, to bring punishment on all of these other nations. And he used the same kind of language. It was figurative, but the picture was God riding this chariot of clouds and ready to fling the lightning bolts, ready to bring an end to their world, and it's couched in end of the world kind of language. And I think it's in the context, Matthew 24, Luke 21, I forget what chapter in Mark it is, but the parallel passages tend to be pointing to the destruction of Jerusalem, and not really the end of time, and not really a resurrection time, but more a matter of Jesus is asserting his authority and putting a squash on the persecution that the Jews had against the Christians. And it shouldn't be surprising that the next picture would be Jesus coming in the clouds, putting the squash on the Romans. God rode in the clouds to put the squash on Egypt and on Edom and on other nations in the Old Testament. Jesus told the priests in his trial, you will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds. And they tore their clothes, calling him a blasphemer. Why? Because only God rides the chariots like rides the clouds like a chariot coming in judgment. And Jesus was putting himself in God's seat, riding God's chariot, coming in judgment against them. And so he was using the same language for himself as God used of himself in the Old Testament. And this is another reason why I believe, you know, that the amillennial view fits, although it is confusing. It is confusing because we're not used to this language of judgment from the Old Testament. And when you read the Bible, well, you take it seriously. And when you're reading something you're taking seriously that comes from another language, figures of speech tend to get literalized, don't they? You know, if you're speaking a second language, people tend to not catch the nuances of the language. I remember, who was it? I forget who it was. There's one fella who English was a second language, and we used the phrase, "You're pulling my leg." No, you're not. They have, you know, there's different idioms, different ways of phrasing things. And one of the ways that the Eastern people phrase things as far as judgment was just like Saddam Hussein in the First Gulf War. Your widows will be beating their breasts. You'll be swimming in your own blood. You'll be charging through a wall of fire. Did any of that literally happen? And even if Hussein was absolutely right about who was going to win the war, did it literally happen? No. What would a British person say? You will be defeated. Soundly. And that's about how much they exaggerate, you know. And we're from that Anglo frame of mind. And so when we talk about ultimate victory, we just get to the point, Joe, let's go. And but when the Easterners start talking about victory and about, you know, what defeat is going to be like, your moon is going to turn into blood and your sun is going to turn into darkness, and you're going to be crawling under the rocks praying that the mountains will fall on top of you, and your earth is going to be shattered. And all of the time throughout all of the Bible, defeat is couched in those terms. And so it's not unusual, and it's not unusual to take that kind of position to say, all right, well, it is figurative, but it doesn't mean it's not true. We just have to understand what the figures mean. Have to understand what the point really is, and then have confidence in what the point is, and believe it. Any questions on any of this stuff? I hope it made it a little bit more clear.